Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. Today, we're joined by Liza Engel, Deloitte Switzerland's Chief Sustainability Officer and Managing Partner. A visionary leader driving sustainable, digital, and agile transformations, Liza has a rich background in branding, marketing, and communications. Liza is a master strategist, redesigning employee life cycles and spearheading talent attraction. She excels in shaping talent and operational excellence, embedding cultures of operational efficiency. An advocate for gender advancement and disability support, Liza is a prominent voice in diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. As an engaging communicator and keynote speaker, her insights on leadership and sustainability are sought after globally. Liza's curiosity and understanding of human behavior fuel her commitment to shaping a sustainable future, making her a key influencer in the realms of sustainability and leadership transformation. I've asked her to join us here today to share her story and how we can all better navigate ourselves into a brighter future. Liza, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Hi, Daryl. Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for the great intro. Wow, I'm proud of myself.
Yeah, you did. I got tripped up. This is the second time we had to do the intro because I kept calling her Angel instead of Engel because her name is Engel, E-N-G-E-L, but it means angel. And I guess that's maybe you're our saving angel today. Maybe that's what it is. It's a great knowledge. Before we get into some of the marketing and strategy stuff in business, how did you even get started? I know you're a fellow Canadian, but how did you even get started in this sort of direction? Were your parents in this field as well?
No, not at all. So I was born and raised in Alberta, Canada. My parents were not in the business world. My dad was a cowboy. He worked for the government. And my mom was also not at all in the business world. And so I remember having a pivotal moment when I was about in grade five, actually, seeing my peers start to talk about jobs and careers and how maybe dad or mom was going to help them. And I thought, I had this moment where I realized if I'm going to get somewhere in life, it's going to have to be with my brain. Mm-hmm. And that's one pivotal moment in my life where I realized, okay, I'm going to have to buckle down. Maybe I might actually have to do something in school and work for success. And I'm really happy. Actually, it happened rather early, grade five. And then when I progressed on, actually, my first year of university, I was a real science and math fanatic. I studied genetics. I was in a program and probably went about it rather naively. So in Switzerland, there's a great process where you go and test out careers. I wish I would have had that as a kid, because had I known that going into genetics means you're going to spend hours and hours in a lab in a white coat with fruit flies. And so I realized in that year, I'm a people person. I love to engage with people. This is not my calling. So I took a year off to the dismay of my family. But since I financed it all myself, there's not too much anybody could do to steer me off. And then with some experience, I did C++ programming. I'm dating myself here. I tried various different things. And then I found my way to commerce and into business. I studied marketing and finance. And after my university career, I really wanted some international experience. And that led me towards Europe. And I came over for a year or two. Came to Switzerland, and I've been here the second half of my life. It's been 25 years on now almost, and I couldn't be happier.
That's excellent. That's excellent. That sounds great. It sounds like a very linear progression path. Was it like the pearly gates of heaven open and it was all sunshine and rainbows and this golden brick road? Or what were some of the greatest challenges in your career and how did you overcome them?
I don't think I've ever met somebody who just had the golden gates and the yellow brick road. I'm here where I am today because I've struggled and I've failed. And I think earlier on in my life, I was really hard on myself. I set myself to almost inhumane standards and really struggled along the way. And I think, again, we're talking about pivotal moments that shape your career. I think the moment I realized that every failure is a nudge in a better direction. Every failure is an opportunity to learn. And once you can start to make that a part of your regenerative system of getting better with each and every struggle, that's when things really started to get better. And I always had a bit of a plan. What I realize is actually the plan you can often throw out the window. It's good to have a North Star, a sense of direction, but you need to be open to the opportunities that life puts you into contact with, and right. You need to be attuned to hop onto those.
Yeah, I forget who said it, but I think maybe it was Voltaire. He said a plan means nothing, but planning is everything. And that's the skill of plan, of being organized, of being aware. The concept of planning is preparation. That's planning. Planning is preparation. So it's the whole Abraham Lincoln. If I had 6 hours or 7 hours to chop down a tree, I'd spend the first six sharpening my axe. It's that preparation part. And that's what planning really is. So you, if this, then that. What are my resources available? All that sort of, I love that. I love that so much. We talked about failure. That's really an important part of all processes. People talk about heaven and hell as if they are, my beef, I'll just say, with the concept of heaven and hell is I just don't notice, I don't know anything I can fathom and have faith, but I don't know anything that's constant. That's constantly that forever, forever, never, 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 never changes. It's great to think that, but from what I understand, I'm more like the yin yang where things oscillate between extremes and that you need failure. You need, it's a movie story where the prodigal child, the scientists have gone looking for them. They don't exist. People have natural inclinations, but I think it was Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called, he wrote a bunch. One was Tipping Point, one was Blink. And he talked about scientists went looking for the prodigal child, the kid that's born and is just gifted. And they just don't exist. You can trace everyone's success down to 10,000 hours invested in something. And then Naval, who's a VC, very successful tech billionaire that I like, he actually says it's not even 10,000 hours in business, it's 10,000 iterations, regardless how many hours it takes you to get it done. And so it's a huge problem. And this all feeds back, sorry, I'm on a soapbox, I'll get off in a second, but I think it feeds back. And I bring this up a lot on my show, but Karl Popper, I love Karl Popper. He was one of the first science educators and he had a formula for the scientific method. And it was P1 plus TS plus EE equals P2. P1, problem one plus TS, temporary solution. Then you eliminate the errors through experimentation, observation, data collection, right? And that leads you to problem two, or you fail to reach problem two, you're stuck at problem one still, but you've learned why your temporary solution doesn't work, you come up with a new hypothesis. And that is the process of evolution. A turtle has 1,000 babies or 100 babies, and how many survive?
Absolutely. Through all of that, it's if you've ever had situations where you've been with multiple people in and afterwards you ask them to describe that situation, you will always get completely different stories. And what we've yes. learned is a lot of it is about the stories that we make out of situations. So are you the hero? Are you the victim? Again, back to that regenerative energy. And the book that I'm reading through the start of the new year is an audiobook, High Potential, from Adam Grant. And he mentions as well that 10,000 hours that you referred to. And in addition to that, he also talks about how important it is play to any of those high performance athletes, those really outstanding musicians. They have found ways or hacks to put in all those hours and still have fun. And they shake it up. They do different things. It's not just, you know, the same drill every single day for 10,000 hours. I think almost no human can handle that.
And I think through the play, you take the seat. I'm a fitness guy. So it's not every day trying to hit your one rep max. It's taking the time to work on the nuanced things, the small pieces. It's taking a part of it apart. And I'm just going to practice this little piece today and have fun and make a little game out of it. And what you're doing is you're getting iterations in that other people aren't doing, that work, that effort. So what would you recommend to someone? Pardon?
Shift this week. So instead of having my kids have the criteria of so many minutes of practicing their instruments every day, I realize this is not a great KPI for them to try and hit. Let's talk about how you can interpret songs and how you can adjust a sad song into a happy song and vice versa. So that's the correction I've done this week in my parenting style, thanks to Adam.
Well, I think it's a bit of both. My daughter goes to a jiu-jitsu school and I mean, she's just a kid. And I know from my playing that a lot of it is about drilling. It's about playing, but there are fundamentals are fundamental for a reason. And I think it's this is great. It's supposed to be your interview, so I'm going to shut up real soon, I promise. But I think this is a good example because in jiu-jitsu, there's sometimes new people come out and they've got some phenomenal strategy. One guy had this thing called the rubber guard, and it worked great. But the problem is it only worked on people that didn't know about it. If you knew about it, you could shut it down and then it doesn't work anymore. You have to hit them with something new they've never seen before, and that works. But there's another guy, Hodger Gracie, who's got an incredible track record in competition, and everybody knows he's gonna judo throw you, he's gonna pass your guard, he's gonna get the top mount, and he's gonna do a gi choke. And this is at the highest echelon. And that's how he wins every match. And the phenomenal part about it is that everybody knows this is how he wins everything. And it's the techniques you learn, like your first month. So the virtue is doing the common uncommonly well. And this guy, he's going to do what you've been exposed to from your first month training, but he's going to walk through all your defenses to it. And that comes down to this. Part of it is you have to drill it to know it. So you have to get the drilling in so you know how to do the movements without the whole conscious competence to then unconscious competence, meaning you don't know what you don't know. You know how much you don't know. Now you know how to do it, and you have to mentally be there to do it. And then you just do it without thinking. And that part, there is some ropes practice in that. So I would say, I'm saying this for your style, the jiu-jitsu school I'm at, the teachers, we don't drill here. We just play games. And I think that's great. One thing I've learned is a lot of his people are so new. They don't have any idea what to play with, what the tools are. So you do need a foundation of just, here's the basics. Let's just do the 20 hours, the 40 hours. But now you have the basics, let's play some games. So let's talk about your career and your growth then. What does it take to climb? Obviously, you're speaking at a relatively prestigious conference soon. What does it take to climb in an international corporation to achieve these things? Failure is not going to get you there.
No, that's not right. But if you are going to, the better you can get off of failure, the faster your progression is going to be. I don't think I had a master plan of being where I am here right now. So we spoke a few minutes ago about planning. I knew I wanted to have an impact. I knew I wanted my life to matter. That's what's driven me. And if I had to say, what is the core aspects of what's gotten me to where I am, a lot of people focus on the what's. What concretely do I have to do? And they just about go crazy trying to figure out that great idea or like, how do I land that great job? The sooner I realized I focus on my, why do I do what I do? What has meaning to me? What lights my fire? What gives me an endless abundance of energy? So I spend a lot of time just now also start the new year. I don't necessarily do New Year's resolutions, but I dedicate really proper time. We're talking about 1 to 3 days in December and January that I dedicate to re-look at my purpose, what I'm proud of in the past year, what do I want to connect with in the new year. And then after that, this is the Simon Sinek, your why, your how, and your what. I focus a lot on the how. So it can be everything from your energy, from physical, mental, emotional, spiritual energy. How do I work on my system? I focus a lot on productivity. Am I really focusing on the things that really make a difference? There's so many tools out there these days that you can bring back to. I'm constantly looking at that part of my system, the energy aspect, as well as how do I do what I do? I'm a mom of three kids. I've always worked full time. If I look back in my career, I have done some pretty tremendous things when you're introducing me, but I don't feel like I am currently in a state where I have to constantly make compromises. I don't feel overstretched, but I have had that in my career. I think hardly find a successful person who hasn't had moments where they really struggled and questioned why they do what they do.
Yeah, an important part. That's whether you believe in immortal souls or that we'll achieve immortality or reincarnation, at any of those, immortality is a factor. Right? You have an immortal soul, or you're going to reincarnate, live over and over again, or we're going to become immortals. Okay. Either one of those, we're talking about an almost infinite timeline. And as a being with a potentially infinite timeline, what would be the trophies you would put on your fireplace? What would be the trophies you would put on your mantle? Is it the time that you pushed a little harder, that you wanted to give up, and you went forward anyhow, that you were afraid and you stood up and showed bravery? Or is the time you took the easy route? is the time you didn't, you sat on the couch an extra minute. Is it, what would make you proud? What would be, what trophies would you collect? And I think that's a really good perspective for people to have. And I think that even comes back, you talk about de-inability, you know, for us, we want to be part of why I think people really feel passionate about those causes is because for a trophy on my immortal mantle, so to speak, it wouldn't be stepping on people less fortunate than me. It wouldn't be sucking everything out of the planet and then having my kids face extinction. Now, how much of that is imagined fear? How much of that is real threat purely? And how much of it is real threat with Trojan horsed agendas that may or may not serve the ultimate goal? That's all up for discussion. But I just think at the core, it comes back to this mindset of wanting to have some sort of legacy, wanting to have some sort of accomplishment that our immortal souls or our immortal selves will be proud of looking back. I definitely agree with you that there.
I think everybody, the word legacy, everybody wants, as I mentioned before, an impact. Everybody, I don't think anybody ever wakes up in the day and says, I'm going to ruin somebody's life. That's my goal today. Or I'm going to destruct something. I believe innately that we're all good people and that we have good intentions. So if there's a situation, for instance, with a low performance, I never believe that somebody gets up and says, I'm going to have a low performance today. It's because there's some sort of a mismatch in that system, and it needs to be corrected. So I believe that we innately are good and that we all are put on this earth to have some sort of an impact. And I'm just trying to make the best of mine.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I may be a little bit jaded through my international travels. I see the Canadian coming out on you. And I feel that way too. And we're saying the same thing. There are people whose existence and purpose in life, I think, is to be a good example of what a bad example is. I think that is just there, unfortunately, as much as you need ugly to have beautiful, you need short people to have tall people. I think there is that. I go back to the yin yang, the duality. But I understand what you say. One of the things that I think was really powerful, I found for me, and I think this feeds into kind of DEI, when I first became an employer of other people, I found that when I was having a great day, I loved my team. And when I wasn't having a good day, I hated my team. And it was all their fault. And that is, I think we've all had toxic boss situations or that. And I think the whole, again, coming back DEI, maybe I should ask you, like, but I think DEI is about trying to get to merit and avoid stereotyping. And actually get to real meaningful KPIs to measure people against, not to change the bar. I had one staff, we did this thing, three key metrics. And so every role, we come up with three key metrics to measure them in. And part of their weekly one-on-ones and that in scorecard is to measure how they perform, 1 to 10, manager rates, they rate themselves, meet in the middle. And I remember we had one staff who was failing to hit get above 8, which is our goal. We want 8.5s if we can. The manager changed the definition of success for one of those metrics so she could hit 8.5s. And I was like, that defeats the whole purpose of the whole system when I found out about it. And what we ended up doing is putting this girl in a new role, and she was getting 9.5s every week all of a sudden because we found where she fit in. What do you think are some of the biggest, I guess, potholes people fall into DEI? DEI on the surface is nice and fluffy and kumbaya, hold hands, but what are some of the trappings that prevent or trip people up, do you think, into doing it well and speaking to the true purpose of it?
I think at first, when companies started to speak about DEI, I think a lot of people were looking for justification to say we are good. Just like when you have purpose statements and these wonderful statements that are created, curated from and polished from a writer or communications team, and they're put up on a wall, and it does have an impact, but it actually can almost have a negative impact if it's really purely just a nice mural in the office. And in fact, below that surface, that shiny surface, nothing is really changing. And I think for me, game changer and DEI topics was really starting to have communities that are speaking to leadership on important decisions, on things that matter, and that they really, truly have an empowered voice. I'll give you a concrete example. Something I was working on a couple of years ago was about, there's maternity leave we had already, and there's a legal requirement in Switzerland, and we had a few additional weeks that could be added on there to extend it and make it more attractive and more family friendly. And the project that we were working on was creating paternity leave, we were calling it, and it was about extended leave for the second parent, basically. And so we were a team of maybe a core team of roughly six people. We had gone through months of this stakeholder roadshows, of going through the various executive meetings. And we were thrilled when it came through and we announced it and we wrote the communications on it. And then I got an email about 2 weeks later after it was announced from one of our community groups, our employee groups. And basically it was the most beautiful, you can do better mail, Liza, that I've ever received. So it was a good full screen long, that email. It was written with care and appreciation, but basically what they were saying is, you messed up, Liza. And concretely, it was from our, at the time it was called our Pride community, our LGBTQAI plus community, and my wording was not open to their needs. So I should have been, we corrected it afterwards to primary parent and secondary parent to give some sort of terminology to the first and the second, but we took away the maternity, the female and the male. So that was, as an example, I thought we were doing the best. I was really proud of what we did, but I realized I could do even better. And so my response that I wrote back was actually, my first paragraph was, no, I've just been sitting here for 10 minutes, starting an email to explain to you why I did what I did. So my first reaction was to justify my actions. And then I reread my mail and corrected myself and realized, here I am once again falling into the traps, what most leaders do, and justify their actions. And then I flipped it and said, I'm sorry, you were right. I made a mistake. Would you sit down with me and help me to rewrite the communications for this and moving forward? And it became the beginning of a really beautiful relationship and super, super powered everything I did in DEI.
What happened? So this is maternal leave for moms, and then... Yes. Paternal leave for the father of the child to be with the mother for the child that they had. I'm just trying to make sure I understand this. And then the issue was they were upset with the language, that it was gender affirming language.
You have two women who've just had a child. The first mother who had the baby, she has the maternal leave, but then you have a second woman who has not physically had the baby, but she is the second caregiver in that context. And she doesn't want to be called, she doesn't want to have paternal leave. She wants a parental leave.
Fair enough. Okay. So what's the outcome? What's the end result of this? Now, what's the proper way to do this according to DEI?
So you would talk about, you know, either primary and secondary caregiver. You'd use terminology like parental care, as opposed to using the terminology that's explicit to a gender. And if you don't know what to do, ask somebody who that pertains to, and they will give you
advice. The birthing mother, the mom, though, that's still okay.
Birthing parent and non-birthing parent, that would be another way to do it too, I believe.
I would die on that hill. Mom is mom. I'm not in a corporation, so I can say whatever I want. But I would say a mom is a mom, and then you can have another parent and all the other stuff. I'm good. I actually, this may be TMI. I want to give some people some background, because I feel like in some ways, maybe my energy is coming off as a bit resistant to some of this stuff. I've actually have a son that's not my son, because I've donated sperm to a lesbian couple where the one parent identifies as a male. So when I push back on some of this stuff, or I seem surprised by it, maybe they just accept my ignorance. Maybe they just accept my ignorance, but I just feel it's a very cool thing, very clear understanding in that respect. Some of this I worry about. I remember as a kid, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words cannot hurt me. And I worry about some of it being us punching ourselves back into a corner. But I think that does make sense. Like, you have maternal leave, because I don't think you could call. We're not going to solve the world's problems with this on this interview, but I think maternal leave. This is just my personal opinion. The only people that care are my followers. Everybody else probably has no care. I think maternal leave could be maternal leaves. And then the other one, you're right. Not all parents will be that. Now, I guess if you have two men, but then they haven't necessarily had a baby.
Could be an adoption. There's also the adoption route. So maybe two men might have adopted. And
So I'm like so in this. I'm like the perfect DEI poster boy. That's an interesting perspective. You adopt a child, you both want to be there to be in its life. I don't know. I still feel if it's two gay men, suck it up, boy. One of you can stay home, sure, or take turns. You know what I learned? I had kids. You mom of three, so you know this. The man is useless the first year, 2 years. It's all about mom and the boobs. It's all about mom. It's all about mom.
As a mom of three, I disagree. And I disagree with you on that one, I have to say. It is not just about feeding. There's so many other things.
No, of course. But the man is an accessory. Like, I was so shocked because when I had my daughter, I was all like, I'm in this 50%. I'll wake up at nights and I'll bottle feed and I'm going to do my part. And maybe it's just a perspective thing. I was so shocked how useless I was. I felt like what it was, Adrian and Rocky. And my wife was like Rocky in the ring and the ding, the bell would go. And then she'd come and I'd be in the corner rubbing her boobs and massaging her shoulders and making sure she's fed and had water. And then pushing her back in when the bell went, because I would take the baby and I would take the baby. But if the baby would want mom, the baby's like, man, I don't want you. Give me my mom. You're like, I did my part. We have pool time, an hour a day. My daughter's really young. We go take my lunch break to the pool and swim. But that's my point for two men. And then again, this is for whatever my feather in the hat, my suggestion in the box is it's two men. You guys can take turns. Because I think that in some respect, people forget that we live in a world of survival. And it's my personal, I agree that, okay, you want to identify something, I need to learn how to address you. But if that's your biggest concern in life, like you forget how this is a fight for survival. There are asteroids headed for our planet right this moment. The sun, it can have a solar flare. There's so much happening in the world that sticks and stones can break your bones, but words cannot hurt you. And I hope I'm not grossly offending you on any of this, but
I would recommend your next person to invite to your podcast, invite two gay men who just adopted a baby.
Yeah, I was an orphan. I had lots of friends who were foster kids, and I have plenty of opinions on that. One thing I will say 100% is there is a massive part of why I even agreed to donate my sperm was I noticed if she hears it, it's hurtful, but I've met my biological mom and my biological family where I was orphaned from. And I met my biological dad who didn't even know I existed. And I recognized the massive difference between people who just have kids and people who want to have kids. And that can make all the difference in a child's life. So I'll put that out there as well.
And at some point in time, either already it's happened or in your life, I think we all have some grudges with our parents. I've never met somebody who's just had everything perfect and so on. And I think when you come to the point in life where you can say, I am who I am because of my life. So life has happened for me, not to me.
Oh, yeah.
That as a child has made you the amazing you that you are.
Sure. And what you just said, I think, is one of the important parts, because we have kind people are easily cannon fodder for psychopaths. This is what I've learned being international, being Canadian. You're Canadian, I'm Canadian, actually both from Alberta. I think that Canadians are so friendly that it is really easy to have a Canadian trip all over their feet if you just try to act like they're offending you, because we're known as the nice, friendly people. And so this comes into a line of assertive, right? Yeah. If your audio can't see, she just made gestures of, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, 100%. We are so nice. We will bend ourselves into pretzels to make sure we don't hurt anyone. And if anyone, and for a psychopath, that is the kids in a candy store, right? Because, and that's where like some of this stuff, like the DI, I think that's part of where there's clash over that. Some people are just jerks and assholes. I don't think I am. But some people are just jerks and assholes and don't care. And some people are too sensitive and need to just suck it up. And then there's the middle ground where there's validity in all of this. And that's why, you know, someone like you is looked to as a leader in this space to help us navigate those treacherous waters.
I think for me, game changer was, so I think it's a really important point what you said. So I not only am I Canadian, I'm also a single child raised in a single parent household. So only experienced conflict and discourse in the workplace. And so I had a big gap that I had to close and learn the hard way. And it was really hard. And then coming to Europe, so in Germanic countries, people are rather black and white, rather, I don't want to use negative words here, but rather it's right or it's wrong. And they might use, you know, Swiss people are polite, they'll use proper language that basically will say to your face, no, you're wrong. And as a Canadian, that was hard in the beginning, right? And I used to really struggle with people who challenged me. I took it personally, and it cost so much of my energy. And for me, the game changer was to really look at this pushback or this person and say, what if I flipped it? What if I flipped it and saw this challenge as a nudge or an opportunity? And then, of course, you learn some of those really golden words to respond and say, thank you so much for this challenge. You've now given me an opportunity to improve. I'll give you a concrete example. In my role as a sustainability officer, we have once a week. Last year, we had a sustainability week. So we changed the canteen for 1 week to have vegetarian and vegan food. Highly disturbing for some people. We have apparently ruined the lives of a few people. It's a small group, but there's a few people who took high offense to that. And I had one gentleman who reached out and said, long mail, once again, I'm imposing my beliefs and my values on others, and how inappropriate is this? And my response was, well, so thank you so much for sharing this with me. I'll gladly sit down with you and talk about some of the facts here. We can do this in a very rational, factual way. And I can also share with you, when we're talking again about DEI, this is also about creating awareness. Do you know how many people who are vegans go to cocktail parties and all they can eat is the olives and the pickled ginger? There's literally nothing there in your typical Swiss cheese and meat platter. Or if you do a sushi platter that's all fish, you're not speaking to the vegan. So that was one response. And then I thanked him and said, you know what, I'm going to now go down to the canteen and I'm going to speak to the people who work there and ensure that they have a proper understanding why we're doing this. Because that was one of his complaints, that the people who work there just rolled their eyes and they didn't know what to do. So I said, thank you. I went down, I made some corrective measures, and look at this great story that this gentleman has given me to speak about.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I do feel, through all the divisive tribes that have been created over the last few years specifically, I think a big part of it is because of a failure to focus on outcomes. Because when you take I actually used to introduce myself as a vegan with meat eating tendencies, because I did this program, Katinovic. You talked about being able to, there's a program in Switzerland, like a trial work thing. You get to try different jobs. What was that thing you mentioned?
So in German, they call it schnuppern, which actually means to go sniff out something. So it starts already at the age of 10. My son already spends a full day once a year where he can go and check out a vocation. And this goes through the educational system of Switzerland.
I love that. Katima, in Canada, we had a program called Katimovic. When I was 17, I got to travel Canada for 9 months. 3 months in a province, and I lived with 10 other kids, half boys, half girls, and it was made up to represent Canada. So we had a couple of French, a couple people from Quebec, one person from Ottawa, one person from Toronto, the West Coast, and then we actually even had an Inuit kid, Kenny, who didn't even speak English when he came. Like, their language was all, like, it sounded like grunts and clacks when I first heard it. That's just how it sounded to me. Kenny, he became a good friend of mine. And it was funny, because at the beginning, Kirsten came, and she was vegan. We had one vegan and two vegetarians, and then everybody became meat eaters, but Kirsten, who stayed vegan. And then by the end, we had three vegans and three vegetarians. And you know what was? It was because the food just was better and healthier. It wasn't about vegan or vegetarianism. It was about, hey, we're just trying to be healthy. And so that's why I talk about the tribes, the people like, hey, we're going to have a vegan. That's why I say, if it was about the outcome, hey, we're going to try to have a healthier menu for people. How does somebody argue with that? I demand you give me sugar-coated corn pops, right? And that's why I say we're getting tribalism versus the outcome. Hey, and I'm just talking, because when you said that, in my mind, I felt like I would be like, hey, I'm not vegan, but if you put we're going to try to have a healthier options. So we're going to have more veggies and stuff. And some of these, if you're vegan, you've got it, like the vegans know what they can eat and can't eat type thing. So anyway, this is it. But I just feel like same thing when it comes to politics. A lot of this stuff now is becoming tribalistic. Are you left? Are you right? Are you this guy's camp or that? We need to get away from that and focus. And even with the DEI stuff, what is the outcome? The outcome is we want a larger labor pool to draw from. We want to pull from diverse experiences and points of view to all collaborate towards a mutual goal and to hopefully have the cream rise to the crop. Sorry.
I just wanted to say, you talk about tribes and polarization. Our world has never been more polarized than it is right now. You're either for or against something, and this happens in every country in the political context, and there's so many examples we could speak about on that. And it's all being fostered by, you know, algorithms. And so I give myself usually one challenge a year, and my challenge last year was to engage with people who have opposing opinions than I do, the attempt to try and convince them, but to try and understand. So just go at it like ask questions. And I think, are you a follower or are you a leader? And I think the difference is consciousness. You mentioned consciousness before. We also spoke about some books. One of my all-time favorite books that I constantly go back to is The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leaders. And in there, you talk about responsibility for your choices, for your actions. And it goes through that. I think there's other things in there as well as integrity. And I can remember all the 15 offhand, or approval, allies, at what win for all or win for one. So there's so many great aspects in this book to cover it. And for me, when I think about being a leader as an individual, and a leader is somebody who influences others. Also as a parent, you influence others. And concretely, my switch to I'm vegetarian because I still like cheese. Right. Not quite fully, but I can say vegan with cheese tendencies. And that was the beginning of COVID, beginning of Corona. A lot of us were doing deep reflection. And I watched, I think it was a YouTube or a TED Talk about, it was called 5-Day Veg. And it was my first step towards learning of the impact of my actions as far as my CO2 output. And that's why the Alberta, who grew up on awesome steaks and burgers, decided to turn her cheek and leave that part of my eating habits behind and switch to the plant-based.
I think that's all a psyop. But yes, it's very noble to do it for the betterment of the planet. It's good to just, like you say, talk to people of different opinions. I think that it's so easy to get triggered by this stuff. And I think we also have to be, this comes back to one of the things that you say, like all of us, I had to talk actually with my team about this earlier today. Kingston, Ontario, where I grew up, is Queen's University. And they did a study because in the summertime, the park is full of squirrels. And they did a study. And if they had observed a squirrel stealing the nuts another squirrel had buried, when that thieving squirrel was burying a nut, if a squirrel saw it while it was burying the nut, it would finish it, leave, and then come back when the other one had left and move the nut it buried. Whereas if a squirrel had never been observed to steal food from another squirrel, it would just bury it, be like, hey, what's up, Fred? And then just keep burying it and then walk off. And it was because it couldn't fathom doing something like that to someone else. And so that's where I said, I feel like this is a psyop. And I said earlier, some of this stuff is very legitimate. Are we overfishing the oceans? 100%. Are we tearing down the rainforest, which could be a cornucopia of undiscovered healing medicines, for sure, 100%, 100%. But is it carbon? Are we getting this as a pure thing, or are people Trojan horsing agendas in there that propels their interests, you know what I mean, wrapped up in a bow? I tell my daughter, the best disguise for an evil person is a good one, right? Nobody ever introduces themselves like, hi, I'm here to fuck you over. Nice to meet you, right? And that comes into this whole...
You can imagine what I said before, I have a rather utopian look on life. I'm aware of it. And part of me I'm never going to give up at least part of it in the core. But going back to what we said, as a Canadian coming here, having a utopian look on life, always trust and believe the good in people. I have my scars and right. I've been bashed around right. And I've learned the hard way. What are some of the... protection mechanism. So we were talking hockey here. What is the guards I have to put on me that I don't get sucked into the vortex? Because I have a right to happiness as well, just as the squirrel who's trying to steal my nuts. Yeah. And I guess the one of the questions I always ask myself after an interaction, particularly in a newer relationship or if you're in a new job, for instance, is why are they saying this to me? So I don't commit to anything in an initial meeting or so. And I allow myself, I'm not an open heart surgeon. There's very few decisions in the business world that you have to make within minutes, really. We act like it is, but rarely. Yeah. So I will take a moment to reflect and really think about I'm good at feeling, sensing people. So why are they telling me this? What's in it for them? What might be their hidden agenda? So those are some steps I do despite my utopian outlook.
Yeah, I wish I knew it because this is one of those things that I've heard and I remembered it, but I don't know all the details properly. But I know in game theory, there's one model where it's like the highest outcome. It's like trust with forgiveness or something like that. This is where I'm poorly paraphrasing this, but it's like blind trust or distrust or trust and distrust. And the ultimate was trust with forgiveness. Because if you stop trusting someone and you close that off, then there was no opportunity for collaboration in the future that might have a success. It was almost like you had more options if you could forgive people. If you had forgiveness, your available options were greater. And I might have all of it wrong, but I just remember that one. The lesson I learned from that was this model, because there's lots of different models in game theory, but this one, the highest performing output was like trusting with forgiveness. It was the with forgiveness. And it was because even if you trusted and got betrayed, to become completely closed off, it prevented you from taking other chances. And so, you know, like you talk about having your scars in this utopian view, that's probably served you really well. That might be part of why you've been able to do the things that you've done. And sometimes I feel like we're there to help teach other people's lessons, even though unfortunately we're the ones that bear the scars. And maybe it's because we're strong enough to bear those scars. You're there to make sure the other person learns the lesson.
Absolutely. There's one other I got now. You're giving me reminders of all my greatest books. I think about 2 years ago, I read a book called Humankind. I'm not so good at remembering the author's names, but Humankind, that uses a lot of examples from history. It's very concrete about why we have the beliefs that we do. And it challenges the theory that people are not kind. So the belief in there is that people are kind, and they talk about history and war. And when you think about, actually, history was written by the conqueror, the one who conquered. And afterwards, they usually had to put some sort of a policing state in to justify why they conquered somebody else. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our legacy and history, the written words, were written by those that conquered. And that really, when you think about a few things.
Is that the truth or not? It comes back to this whole cow farts are going to boil the oceans. Like the earth produces 3,060 gigatons of carbon, roughly. And has natural filtration recycling processes for all that. Humans are producing 40 gigatons of carbon against 3,060. So that's just such a big number. Now, the other thing people don't talk about is the sun. A lot of people don't know this, but the magnetic fields of the earth are weakening right now. The magnetic fields of the earth can flip, and they do flip roughly every 12,000 years or so, with every occasional 6,000 hiccups. And that magnetic field, if you were to take the sun, it would be, if you can see, it's the size of my fist, and the earth is the size of the tip of my pen here, this tiny thing. The sun influences climate on earth more than anything else. And people talk about global warming since when? You can say the globe is warming or cooling depending on when you start your measurements from. Because the ball been an ice ball a couple of times over. It was all lava a couple of times over. So this is some of that stuff. So again, it comes back to the outcome. And I think there's a lot of things like people know it's hot in a city because it's a concrete jungle. Why don't we have more living walls? That's why, again, it comes back to what are some of the outcomes? And I feel like we have to be focused on the outcomes, because otherwise, if we get into tribal politics and drink the Kool-Aid, like propaganda, support our troops. Of course, you're going to support your troops. They're your brothers, your sisters, your husbands, your wives, your neighbors. But do you support what they're actually going out to fight for? That's a totally different conversation.
You're focused on the outcomes. We've known about global warming. There's data that supports, knows that the oil and gas industry knew about global warming already back in the 40s, 50s. It's what you do with that information. And if you focus on the outcomes, the add on to that sentence is in what time period? So often in life, we're focusing on the outcomes literally just in the next 12 months, quarterly reports.
Right.
This is how.
Yeah.
And there are some game changing people out there, like Paul Polman, who I believe was the former CEO of Unilever, who was one of the first CEOs to say, I'm not doing quarterly reports. This is not good for business, and completely shifted the perspective on what kind of outcomes are we going to focus on.
Yeah. And being sustainable, it can be smarter as well, in the sense of whey protein is a highly profitable product, and it used to be a waste product from milk production process. Paul something, he started ZERI, the Zero Emissions Research Institute, because he started two businesses. One was a zero emissions car wash. The other one was a brewery. And I don't know the details about the car wash, but the brewery had a water wheel powered by a river. And then the leftover hops they used to feed chickens. And then the chicken manure they grew mushrooms on. And it was this thing where every input, its outputs were used to create a product, and became a highly profitable business. A lot of lumber, you talk about lumbering, I forget the name, there's a term for it, but in Japan, they have a process of lumbering where they'll harvest a tree, but they'll leave the bottom of the tree in place. And they just train the branches to grow straight up. It's die something. But so they have a tree and they keep the stumps. So it's more, oh, it's time to harvest. And then they leave the tree there. They don't kill the tree. And so there's nothing left. They leave the base of the tree intact. There was a documentary by that nature documentary guy on Netflix. And he talked about the thing that jumped out at me. There was a community somewhere, I think in Oceania, and they had been overfishing. And what they did is they created protected habitat. And the overgrowth from the protective habitat has created a larger fishing industry than they've ever had by giving the nature a safe space to live in and pour out of. It makes smart business sense, sustainability, be using our resources better. There's no animals in the wilderness that are like, hey, where's that drinking hole? I need to take a dump. Like they don't defecate in their water supply, right? There's lots of ways we could be doing things smarter. What are some of the skills and behaviors that you think we need to adopt as business leaders going into this new future? And like I said, navigating these things, because some things are very real. Some might have hidden agendas, but at the end of the day, we do want a more inclusive society. We do want the best person for the job to rise to the top. We do want to have, everybody would love to live in a Garden of Eden. What are some of the skills and behaviors they think are most important?
If I start a bit from the outcomes and go back to skills and behaviors, I think what defines sustainable transformation in today's business world is very much about not just looking at reducing negative impacts, but about creating positive value and then redefining what that positive value is. And you referred to it a couple of minutes ago about the short-term plan versus the long-term plan. I've worked in ICT companies where you have a 25-year plan when it's talking about investing in your network and rolling that out.
Yep.
And I've also professional services that really starts at zero on the 1st of June every year. So I think one is really rethinking about creating positive value. There's obviously so many examples around a company like Patagonia, and what was just in the news recently, the first week of Jan, they shut down business, where all the other companies are having these blowout Boxing Day sales and the like. Patagonia stores were closed with the sign saying, we're giving our employees the week off. They're hopefully creating walking many kilometers. They're going to come back tired and happy because they've experienced nature and life. And that is an example of how you redefine your KPIs, and they're very strong also on the social impact, not just the environmental. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean in concrete skills? I think one is, I've been told before, I reflect too much. I believe that's one of my secret sauces. I think that's one of my superpowers. I think the world could use some more reflection to think about what worked there really well and what less. That comes also from my agile background. You're constantly doing retros to improve each and every iteration. But in order to improve, you have to go back to what does good look like? What is the standards that we're going to hold ourselves to? And it can't be monetary values today in the next quarter. It needs to be, in addition to that, I'm not saying we have to look away from creating revenues and profits, but it's about rethinking how we get there.
Yeah, I love that. And I agree wholeheartedly. And you talked about the company that had a 25-year plan and talked about investing. People are an investment. Again, all a company is a group of people that solve the pain of another group of people, and they do it via a product or service. And that, and so investing in people by giving parents time off to be with their family, like you said, morale and mental health, those are important things. Family is an important thing. We're not replacing ourselves as a species anymore. It's becoming a global phenomenon, specifically since COVID happened. And so this is a real issue where it's, well, who are going to be the people? Who are going to be the customers? Who are going to be the staff? Like, we're all going to get old eventually unless we do achieve immortality. And who's going to change our bedpans? Who's going to help us up the stairs? Or
there's a title.
Yeah. So I love that investment. And actually, I want to be respectful of your time, so we'll wrap this up. But I did spend $50,000 on research into the critical success factors for small and medium-sized businesses. And we uncovered 8 critical success factors. One of them was marketing strategy. But once we defined all 8, we dove into each kind of vertical. And I was really surprised and pleased to find that actually one of the sub-pillars of a marketing strategy that works is corporate social responsibility, which is defined by community development, ethical values, and conformity to legal processes, that you will be more successful if your marketing and your business is actually like brand trustworthy. And integrity was another one: transparency, customer focused, USP, authenticity, brand consistency, clear brand purpose and promise. Just as a great example, these COVID vaccines were supposed to be like the saviors of the planet. I think there's a lot of people that don't know if things were really integrity, trustworthy, and if there was ethical, legal compliance to a lot of this stuff. And so the uptake for the new ones, I'm not trying to answer whether it was or wasn't. I'm talking about people don't feel it was. And therefore, the uptake on these new ones is abysmal. It's non-existent. The Pfizer, Moderna, their stocks are like flaming nosedives right now. They're train wrecks because of that. And it's a failure to put people first. And I think that all feeds into the value and importance of things like DEI in principle.
And I think actually wrapping up everything that we've just discussed, you've asked me what has made me successful, or how that question that we might start off in our career thinking about, how will I be successful? How will I make the bucks that I can have, the life that I want to have? I think the question needs to be, who do I want to be, number one, yeah, and what problem am I going to solve for whom? And yeah, that's what into it. But if it also, not an individual, but also a company, thinks about what problem am I going to solve for whom, you have then a client base. You then have a community who is not fighting against you, but they want you to be successful. And then it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy.
I love that. That is so great. That is so great. Liza, thank you so much for coming and sharing with us. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that I should have asked you about?
Oh, that's a really great question. Yeah, I mentioned what my challenge for myself was last year, speaking to people who have different opinions than I do. Maybe there's a question off of that you want to ask me.
I don't know. I have a different opinion than you do. Do I have a different opinion than you do? Is that?
I don't know. So if we were to set for ourselves, what is the challenge we want to take this year into us? AI is everywhere, right?
Right.
I've been told already before, step aside, Liza, sustainability is no longer the thing. It's now AI. And I think we have to stop thinking about polarization and one-offs. Sustainability will be a part of everything, as will AI. And it's going to be an exciting year. And I look forward to seeing where it's going. And I will remain a utopist and believe that there is good in the world.
And if people want to contact you, if they want to learn more, where should they go to get in touch?
The fastest way on lizaengel.com. That's my own site where I talk about impactful communication, as well as offering my abilities as a keynote speaker. I can also be found on LinkedIn, Liza Engel, and look forward to hearing from you or anybody else who'd like to reach out and talk about these kind of topics and more.
Yeah, so go find her on LinkedIn or go to her website, lizaengel.com. That is lizaengel.com. You can also search that on LinkedIn. Liza, thank you so much for joining us, knowing that you have your own family, your own direct reports, your own conference, your own work, all this stuff to prepare for. Thank you for coming and sharing with me and mine, so we can all do a little bit better.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.